We bought the land at the corner of Kitchener and Sherlock Street in 1920, proceeded to build our dwelling of two rooms and a place for a bathtub, which we never got. We caught the water from the roof in a barrel and piped it into the kitchen. Before we dug a well, the well digging was quite a business. I picked away at the hard pan for 20 feet, then struck a rock. This had to be blasted, putting a charge under it to loosen it up, and scramble up a ladder before it went off, then down again to make another blast to break it up. And believe me, I had goose pimples getting out of that well before the blast went off. But we struck water, and plenty of it, at 24 feet. But it dried up soon after, and we had to dig down to 32 feet. With that amount of experience in using explosive, I was anxious to get on with the blowing of some of the stumps. I met a friend down in Vancouver a week later who was working on a big construction job. He told me of my job of getting rid of the stumps. He could help me to get some blasting powder. And the plan was for me to meet him at 11 o'clock one night along the waterfront at a certain place. And he would come with a boat, and we would get about 50 pounds of it. On the night plan, I thought I might as well take my wife along. So off we went from Lockdale. In an hour or two, got to the waterfront at the appointed place. Well, it was dark as pitch. We could see a few distant lights on the north shore and waited with a large bag that we had brought along. Soon we heard the splash of oars and the big rowboat came into shore. Well, there was a good supply of powder and detonators, etc. Everything to make everything move. But it was not stumping powder, it was a real big-eye explosive material. Well, I filled up the bag and pressed it in tight and headed for Aston Street to get on the last streetcar. We got aboard, and then, for the first time, the thought struck me that there was enough material to blow everything in the car and everything all to hell. Well, I could feel the blood in my face and hands drain away with the thought of it. I looked at my wife, and she was in the same condition. At the next stop, a policeman came aboard and sat down at the other end of the car. At the next stop, another policeman came aboard at my end of the car and sat down. I knew I was trapped. The car was loaded with people, and going up the hill, the fuse over the motorman's head blew out with a loud bang. Well, my stomach went into a knot, and I looked at the police, but they had not moved an inch. Well, I thought they were going to grab me. Then they got up and came in my direction. I did not dare look at them. They both passed me, and I got off at the next stop. And that did not help me very much. We arrived at Boundary Road Junction, and we got off the car without saying a word to each other and dragged this load to the dinky, the extension car. Got aboard, and while lifting up the steps, the bottom of the bag came apart. Some of the sticks fell out. The conductor said, "What is that stuff?" I said, "That's patent fire lighters." What a damn lie it was. So we promptly produced some cord and wrapped it around the grip, and off we went to Lockdale. And landed home two complete nervous wrecks. And stayed that way for nearly 2 weeks. And it never occurred to me at the time to get off the streetcar and get me home some other way. Well, the next morning, my wife asked me where the stuff was. I said, "It's under the floor. I put it under there last night. At least we were still alive, and that was something." There were some settlers that came to Lockdale about the year 1900. One was named Mr. Amos. He built a log cabin on Kensington Avenue. Another man was the name of Powell, who lived next to him. There's another record of these settlers, but I write of those that I met and came to know. On Aston Street, there were the Normans, a very large family, and a family named Jones on Curtis Street. And then there were the Tomlinsons. Mr. Tomlinson is one of the Yukon gold miners of 1896. And there was a Mr. and Mrs. Somebody or other who had a store, and a Mr. and Mrs. Matthews on First Avenue off Curtis Street, going up the top of the Burnaby Mountain. And on the top lived another man in a small shack right on top of the mountain. He had a very good spring of fresh water. Another settler also had a small shack close by. He planted some fruit trees, but the deer chewed these so badly that they could not grow. There was a Mr. and Mrs. Lyons near the corner of Sperling and Broadway, and the Reeder family with two boys. They were Italians, and Mr. and Mrs. George Green with two girls and three boys. And Mr. George Green and his eldest boy, Bob, went to France in the forestry corps in World War I. Both came back. There was also Mr. and Mrs. Summers on Duthers Avenue. Halfway down the Bainbridge lived Mr. Philpott and his sister and two boys. At the bottom of the hill, Mr. and Mrs. Clark. Their son also went to France with the army. He also came back. I met him by accident at Burnaby Lake Station one day, on the day he returned, and brought him across the lake in a rowboat to his home on the other side of the lake. These settlers resided in Lockdale before the 1914-1918. I was the first settler after the war in this district and bought 5 acres of land. from Grandin Fowler of the Inman Estate. The Inman Estate covered all the land from Spurling Avenue to the top of Burnaby Mountain and up to the two government reserves, each of which had about 160 acres each. Then came Mr. and Mrs. McGann. They bought 6 acres between Sherlock and Cliff on the border of Kitchener Street. Then came Mr. Mitchell, he came on a piece of land next to McGann. Then Mr. Hawthorne. They bought the next place, and then Mr. and Mrs. Little bought the part of the Sherlock and Curtis Street on the corner. There were two other men also settled in the district, and then Mr. and Mrs. Hawthorne bought land near Spurling and Curtis. Then Mr. and Mrs. Adams bought some acres on Spurling, just off Curtis Avenue. And Mr. and Mrs. Reilly bought several acres on Sherlock Street. And behind them, Mr. and Mrs. Coop on Duthie Avenue, and there were several others that came in. All these settlers built a home of some sort on their property. All left in the course of time. Death took some from lack of income, but all of them cleared 1 to 6 acres. It was hard, back-breaking work, and the soil gave nothing till it was built up and tilled many times. No one took time off for holidays, but kept on blasting, sawing, prying, lifting, burning, digging, sometimes from 5 in the morning to 11 at night. For those that went away to work, it was weekends, public holidays, etc. Various kinds of stump pullers were tried and given up. Only fire and blasting would remove these great stumps. Hard times came in the 1920s. Relief work was started, and several of us had to apply. An investigator would come to the house, ask us for our financial standing, etc. We had a gramophone. If we did, we must sell it. No, we had not got rich enough to buy one yet. Have we any insurance? No, we had no insurance. Did we go to church? Which one? I replied, there is a church up the hill, but no minister and no congregation. But the minister in that church would have died of starvation. One thing we did have was lots of it. That was firewood. Cords and cords of it, but it was uneatable. We could not make pants out of it. And worse still, we could not sell any of it, for everyone had lots of that stuff. 10 years later, another depression came. We used it for money and exchange. Well, the day came when we were put to work. Some bureaucrat over in Municipal Hall decreed that we were all to assemble at the cemetery site at the foot of Burnaby Mountain on Monday morning and not be late. It was a 2-mile hike over the stumps, logs, and brush. When we arrived, we were given an 18-pound hammer and orders to break up 1 cubic yard of boulders, of which there were tons scattered around, and pile the work in neat piles for inspection. Then some other jackass came on payday, and we were to go to Mrs. Goodridge's store on Hastings Street, which is another hike of 3 miles in another direction, to collect a small paycheck. My neighbor McGann was also investigated. He had a Model T Ford and a cow. He was rich, beside the rest of us. So he was told to sell all and go forth. An argument arose, and he asked the investigator if he would buy a dry cow and a Ford without a license. He replied no. In the end, he was told to get his hammer and go to work. Well, one day of that work, and he handed back the hammer and told the farmer that he would take his shotgun and get more food off Burnaby Mountain with a shotgun than he could buy smashing rocks with an 18-pound hammer. And he did just that. Well, that job came to an end, and I gathered together some various machines and sold them to make a down payment on a drag saw. I went up the mountain and cut down every tree I could, and I sold them to a trucker for firewood for $3 a cord in the bush. Why Burnaby Mountain had been left so long without any move made to make it into a pleasure park for the people of Burnaby is a mystery to me. 1 million people went to Seattle in 1962 to see a space needle about 40 feet across the top. And here is a mountain in space, over 1,000 feet above sea level, and 1,000 acres of it, and to date nothing has been done with it. For here could be placed wonderful gardens, tennis courts, archery courts, swimming pools, cable car to get the top, a long spiral auto road with rock gardens. They could have fireworks display on occasions and many other items. Telescopes to see several hundred miles of territory in every direction. I'm writing this in the year 1963. No other place in Canada would let this fine place go like this. It has great possibilities. It would great big dining halls could be placed up there. Would draw thousands of people. At the time, at the present moment, there is nothing being done about it at all.